It's Arnold Bjorn with Warm Welcome, a show about passionate people and how hospitality plays a part in what they do. Today, we sit down with Zach from Kettle Tea, based in Brooklyn, New York. It is a tea company that sources high premium loose leaf tea, specifically green tea from Japan. He has business partners in Japan that are based there that help him source the perfect product. He has been in business for over 5 years and has most recently found a permanent home above a restaurant called Okonomi in Williamsburg. It's quite funny because I used to live just a couple blocks from there in Williamsburg, and I would pass by it often wondering what it was. But I had a chance to finally go in a couple weeks ago as I have gotten more into teas and kind of searching for more tea houses in New York. I had a great time, and Zach did a wonderful job kind of guiding me through the different products that he had available, allowed me to taste a few as well, and then I really enjoyed that kind of interaction with him. And I think he did a great job of really harnessing hospitality and conveying that with me. And I had really a great experience there. And I want to kind of pick his brain a little bit more, maybe share his story about his early euphoric moments, you know, how he came into the tea business, some failures maybe along the way as well, and, you know, what's next for Kettle Tea. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Would love to kind of just jump right in here and have you talk maybe a little bit about your background, because I know you went to school for music, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I went to school in Boston, Berklee College of Music, in early-ish 2000s. And prior to that, had been, you know, pretty dedicated to music, specifically drums, jazz performance, and through college, studied, played music, toured, and then after college, moved to New York and continued teaching and playing, touring.
Yeah. Did you, growing up, were you always like a musician too, or what was?
I mean, from fifth grade on, yeah, when you had to choose an instrument, I chose the snare drum and then just never stopped. And I actually played it so much before the first, lesson that we had at school that I had broke the drum head, and I thought I like wouldn't tell my parents because I thought I broke the whole drum. I didn't even know how it worked.
To get the tears off.
Yeah, and then like the teacher was like, "Oh, you can take the head off and put a new one on," but he's like, "I've never seen a kid like
break it before."
But I was just obsessed.
It was simply because you were playing so much and practicing so much,
and probably very hard as well. But my dad, I grew up, you know, my parents both, but more definitely my dad were into music and still into music. So I never grew up thinking like, oh, I'm going to be a musician, but it was a big part of my, and still is a big part of my life.
Yeah. Well, growing up, what was playing in your household?
Well, definitely Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan was and remains sort of the, like, anyone who knows my dad is like, you know, knows how much he loves Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
So I grew up with like a lot of like people you'd associate with him too, like George Harrison, the Beatles, the Who. You know, but Dylan was and he's the king. So I, you know, it's funny, when I was younger, I wasn't particularly like, it was just something that was on. And, you know, it's funny, I like came to it in my own way in college, and, you know, everyone,
kind of
my sisters, everyone's a big, and my mom like has never stated that she's a Bob Dylan fan, but just by osmosis, she knows every, you know, the lyric to every single song. She's been dragged along to all the concerts. So, yeah,
that's awesome. And did you play jazz drums specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I always played all sorts of music, but I was drawn to jazz, and I had a great opportunity. Growing up in Minnesota, there's a drummer, Dave King, who is world-renowned, plays this band, The Bad Plus, is sort of his most well-known group. I started studying with him when I was like maybe 15.
Wow.
And yeah, it was just, things really changed after that. I had been into sort of progressive music in the sense of really trying to like master the instrument technically, but meeting him, I was able to like inherit this whole new like view of how, you know, the creativity of music, the expression of music, and just a really interesting worldview for a 15-year-old
like a nice
kid to get. Yeah,
101 class. Huh?
Yeah, I mean, it was every Thursday. I never missed it. We, you know, and it was as much about life as it was about music, and we're still very close friends. And I don't play as much anymore, but I still use, you know, that the things that I learned in those lessons in what I do now and probably the things I'll do in the future.
Yeah. I really want to talk about this because I'm just so curious. I was looking you up and I came across this Kickstarter campaign.
Oh, dear.
We need to talk about this because you don't talk about it on the other interviews that you've had. Secret Architecture.
Yeah. Secret Architecture was a band that I had. It started with a Scottish saxophonist, Fraser Campbell. We started as a duo. We met in college, and then it kind of was like a collaborative thing where it would be the two of us, and then we would kind of augment with other people. It was an opportunity to bring our music in and play it with other people. So we had a lot of sort of versions of the band, but it grew to actually become a quartet, two saxophones, bass and drums, and then actually changed into saxophone, piano, bass and drums. And that was sort of the two most common ways you would see the band. So we released a few records.
Right.
We actually had a West Village residency for 3 years. We played every Sunday night for 3 years.
Yeah. Wow.
And I think we missed maybe one or two, but we played very, I don't know that many working bands that get a chance to play a consistent gig every week.
And so, for 3 years.
For 3 years. Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And so you said the third person is usually the pianist that switches
over? So it actually went to a quartet. Maybe I misspoke. It was Fraser and myself and then a bassist. Mm. And at one point, alto sax, and then kind of like the end and later stages of the band, it
That's
was
awesome.
Piano.
So it's the chord two, and then the other kind of two switch on and off and it's rotating for 3 years.
Yeah.
And along the way, it was noted that you also worked at a tea shop. So how did that kind of come into the equation?
Yeah. So the funny thing is I always when I moved to New York, I was moving here for
music.
But I started working for a Japanese tea company immediately because right at sort of the tail end of college, I got interested in tea, specifically Japanese tea. I was traveling on tour in Paris, and I had known about Japanese tea from actually some reading I was doing. This guy, Dr. Andrew Weil, who's like a amazing, amazing person. He's founded integrative medicine. It's kind of an intelligent combination of Eastern and Western.
Yep.
And he talked a lot about Japanese tea, and I was drinking it sort of like the stuff I could get from like Whole Foods. And then when I was in Paris, I tried real loose leaf tea, and I was
of all places.
Yeah, I was really blown away. And that was sort of at the end of college. So when I would come down to New York, I would go to this tea shop, and I got really interested in it. Just, I have a tendency to get very drawn to things and get,
go down the rabbit hole.
Oh my God, I've had so many rabbit holes. And, I thought it was just going to be another kind of
intense hobby.
But, when I moved here, I needed work. When I moved to New York, my career wasn't in any place that I could just,
In addition to performing.
Right. Yeah. So I needed work. And it's a funny story. I sent them my resume. And I didn't hear back. So I sent it a second time and I didn't hear back. I just kept sending it to them. And finally, the manager of the store
got annoyed.
Yeah. And she was like, okay, we understand that you want to work here. You can stop sending it to us. Just come in. So I went in and I, at that point, had like just on my own had all their teas, memorized them all. Like,
that's insane.
It was just what I like to do. I
just
spend all my time doing that. And, and I got a job there, and that's how that was like my real entry point into tea.
Talk to us a little bit about that tea shop and what does this still exist?
No, it's a great. I mean, everyone who works at the company's, the company still exists. It's Itoen is the name of the it's massive in Japan. They're one of the largest beverage companies, more well known for their bottled drinks, but they do have a line of loose tea as well. So they had a beautiful flagship store on the Upper East Side. It's no longer there, but the company still exists in Brooklyn, and their American office is in Brooklyn. So yeah, they were really focused on Japanese ceramics and tea. They do carry tea from other origins as well, but I was always really fascinated with Japanese teas. And then from working there, the ceramics, there was a another staff, still a good friend of mine, Akiko-san, who really taught me about ceramics, incense, all the stuff that was like part and parcel for the Japanese tea, the things that go along with it. And I just got really into it all.
So, right. Yeah. And kind of the service style, was it like a ceremonial style? Like, what was the service style?
So it was
there?
A retail store. There was a beautiful restaurant above, sort of a in the style of Kaiseki, but mm-hmm. I think they also had, if I remember right, like a omakase sushi bar as well. So downstairs, it was only retail, but it was you know, it was like that next level retail where you're really, it's almost like one to one.
Right.
Someone comes in, you're working with the customer, and oftentimes you're able to sample the teas for them and really. You know, it wasn't you're just, hey, let me know if you need anything, I'll be over here. So we got to really like
engage.
Yeah, engage. And also we had to know more about the product. So we were really responsible for.
And the clientele, the people that are coming through those doors, like, can you describe to me like who?
You know, it's funny. Some of those customers are now my customers. So I can tell you there's everything from touring jazz musicians that would come to, you know, fixtures of the neighborhood. I mean, it was the Upper East Side. So we did get a lot of people that. Would come.
It's an interesting place to have a Japanese, like, in my opinion, like.
Oh no, it is, and you know, that could have been the fatal flaw. I'm not sure. You know, I wasn't involved in any of that, but I, thinking about it now, having a business, I don't know. I mean, it's a good place to put a flagship where you're,
right.
You know, where you're trying to sort of market yourself as
a premium, luxury
premium
product.
And it was that type of store, but it was maybe a little too early.
Yeah. Because there's one in Ipoto, in Midtown?
Yeah, Ipoto, yep.
Is that kind of like a similar layout, right? The second
level?
Yeah,
it's actually, you're exactly right. It's a very similar, you know, it's a large counter
right.
products. You can, there you can like buy tea to go, but you can't stay there. We didn't even actually sell like cups of tea. It was all retail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, as we all know, and maybe people don't know, but as there's different types of teas, right? Whether it's green, black, oolong, pu'er. What about Japanese green tea specifically kind of like spoke to you early on, do you think?
For me, I mean, first and foremost, I do enjoy tea from, you know, around the world. And but there is something specific about the first time I had it that it delivers an experience that's very singular. And it's for a lot of reasons, the way that it's processed and, you know, the manufactured and grown and the point of view that they take on what tea should taste like.
Yeah.
And I'd never had anything like it. I think for sure the aspects of the umami, the savory quality, the round richness, the like how satisfying it was. It was almost like having a meal. You know, it satisfied you on a level that was very different than just sort of the, oh, I'm enjoying this color or flavor or aroma. It was really like integrated as an experience. So and I also feel, I always say that, I've told this story before, I have a really strong memory of when I was a kid, my dad would ride on the lawnmower with him, like while he'd cut the grass. Where we grew up, actually before I moved to Minnesota, we were in Pennsylvania, we had a big yard, and something about that grass smell had some, like the first time I smelled Japanese tea, the way it was processed, distinctly reminded me of like that mowed lawn.
Yeah.
And I think that probably at some level is what, you know, I connected with it there.
Yeah.
So I still love, I always have my face buried in the package smelling the tea.
And you're thinking about that child.
I don't always think about it directly, but I'm sure it's like something in my deep brain is lighting up.
That's crazy. And the other story that I've been reading is how you were at the store and kind of like founding this company was primarily due to these two customers that came by the store, right?
So I guess, I don't know if we've mentioned this yet, but the company that I now have, Kettle, is, you know, we focus on teas that are solely in Japan, only in one origin, the country of Japan, but many different prefectures. So how I made the step from working for a tea company to having a tea company was, it was not planned for sure. There were two big things that happened. One is a couple of gentlemen from Japan came into the shop and were obviously like curious, you know, they were, you know, talking to each other in Japanese and really like kind of checking out the shop. So I engaged with them, you know, they were really open and we had a great conversation. And at one point I said, well, can I make tea for you? And they said, sure. So instead of making tea that we had at the shop, I had recently been brought a sample of some tea from Japan that I was really enjoying. I actually preferred it to what was at the shop.
Yeah.
So I like cracked some of that open and made it for them and their face lit up. They were like, can we see the package? They looked at it and it turns out the tea's from the prefecture where they're living in Fukuoka, and they knew that particular producer. They drank it at their office. So they were just, it was like a real, you know, it was a moment of like, wow, like unbelievable coincidence. But they did leave saying, hey, if you ever come and you'd like to, you know, experience that farm or learn more about Fukuoka, please let us know. So the second thing that happened was they decided to close the store maybe 6 months after that. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, they had planned that and they actually had to lay me off. So I got a severance check, which I wasn't expecting. And I don't remember what it was for, but it was more money than I was expecting any time. I immediately didn't even think twice. I said, I'm going to go to Japan. So I booked a ticket for a month to Japan. Yeah. And not even totally remembering the offer, but once I arrived there, I said, oh my gosh, I think those guys invited me to Fukuoka. So I did reach out to them. We had like corresponded a little bit over email.
Yeah.
And sure enough, they said, come. And I went and they were very warm and welcoming and they took me to the farm and I was actually face to face with the gentleman who made that tea that I shared with them in New York. And that was the moment where I really learned that the best experience of drinking tea is at origin, because you're with the people that know that have made it, that the freshness is obviously optimal because it's coming from, you know, from
literally the backyard, maybe.
right there. And you know, and also the quality of what you can get access to in Japan is higher and more varied as well. So it just got the wheels spinning of like, you know, it was a selfish endeavor, like, oh, I want to drink this every day, so I'd love to have that. How can I get that? And then it turned into someone being like, hey, you know, maybe other people would want to try it. So that's what set off the maybe I should start a business.
Right. And was this your first time in Japan?
That was my first time in Japan. It was 2010.
Wow.
Yeah, April to May. It was right timed with the new harvest. So I was there actually
around this time,
probably. Is that 9 years ago? Wow. Like it was literally right during, because this is when harvest season is.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And tell us about that though. Like, did you speak any Japanese? Like, what was your?
Oh, not at all. No.
Yeah.
No. I just went with a passport, some like light luggage. I remember setting it up in different sections. I went, number one, I ran a marathon while I was there.
In Japan?
In Japan. Like 2 days after I got there, not having any idea about the jet lag. So I really was like, you know, that was fun for about 10 minutes. Yeah. And I was like, okay, I shouldn't have done this. But anyway, I did that in Nagano. And then I played a music festival with my friends, some like very avant-garde like festival in Yokohama, which was awesome. But it was like probably some of the oudest music I've ever played, and the crowd loved it. It was great. And then the other part was just like, I'm gonna go find tea. So like prior to going to Fukuoka, I was just getting off the train places and walking. Like I went to Shizuoka, and Shizuoka is a huge place, and it's just for some reference, it's the largest area of production of tea in Japan. So you're on the bullet train and you're looking and you're like, there's tea everywhere.
Wow.
I'll just get off the train. But you get off in the city and there's no tea like right near the train station. So I basically like wandered until I was literally walking through the fields and people were just, and I remember I had a Zoom, I think. It was like one of those like camera, no, what is it called? Anyway, it was before iPhones. It was like a camera that you could like record. And I was like walking around with like this camera and everyone was like, okay, well, cool. Come over here. And they would make tea for me. And we were just communicating like the best we could, but you know, and that, I mean, that didn't really lead to anything other than just goodwill between me and some.
Yeah, but can you talk about that brand of hospitality though? Because I feel like that it just Japanese people in general embody that so much.
Absolutely.
For them to just like reach out to.
Yeah, I have so many stories on that trip where, you know, people would take real, like, you know, interest in someone being interested in what they're doing.
That's amazing.
Because it's, you know, it's happening more now because the world's shrinking, the internet, you know, everyone's can get connected to people. But I still feel like this was at that point where there wasn't that many people, especially non-Japanese people, that were showing strong interest in tea. So, you know, they could recognize that I was sincere. You know, I didn't have much in the way of, you know, Japanese, so I couldn't really express too much, just the basics. But they, and this is something that you often see in Japan, is, you know, there's an initial sort of awkwardness because they're shy to engage because they're obviously feeling, you know, like not the best about their English and I'm not feeling the best about my Japanese. But once you get through that, like there's an innate sort of like, okay, well, what do you want to see? What can we do for you? We'll take time to show you. Like, I love, they're never in a rush, you know, especially in the countryside. People will stop what they're doing and they'll spend time with you, whether that's showing you some of the fields or being like, hey, do you want to go to the factory?
Yeah.
Like, they offer that. You don't have to ask. So, I mean, I see that to this day. People really do go out of their way to, you know, because I think, number one, they're proud of what they're doing. And it's not always that people are coming, you know, to learn or to look or to find out. So they're excited to share that, yeah.
Yeah. So right now, first of all, the name Kettle, where did that come from?
So Kettle is, you know, the same as the tea kettle. It really was, when I was going through names, I was trying to think about what was the sort of, you know, when I thought about tea, what was kind of the defining feeling or sense I got when I thought about what I wanted the company to feel like.
Sure.
And the kettle going on the fire, you know.
And that noise.
Like, yeah, and just that, like, okay, like, here we go. You know, it's that real central gathering point. It's what people, and, you know, not so much today, but, you know, in the past had gathered around, and it was really, like, central to the experience of tea. And I just liked the sound of it, and, you know, I felt like the E was unnecessary. So later I was told that was great for our search results, which, you know, that was a happy accident because, you know, obviously if you type kettle with
without
an E, there's a million kettles, you know, they're being sold. So it was a little something different, but the three dots above it have a story, though. I don't know if you guys will be able to see it, but you can search for Kettle Tea and you can see our logo. It's got three sort
of like the orange,
oranges, yellow, red dots. So typically in Japan, and you'll see this in more Ippodo, for example, their logo is made with a triangle of three dots. And what that there's a couple of stories to that. Number one is it denoted on a map where tea fields were in Japan.
Wow.
So if you were looking at a map, you know, 200 years ago when you were trying to distinguish the, you know, what's going on in that area, if that was on there, that denoted that, yes, that's where tea is being grown. But where the one step before that, if you open the seed of a tea plant inside where the seeds are lay out, they actually lay as three seeds in a triangle like that. So the tea seed inside the small seed, it's like, I guess it's like a large, you know, kind of covering for that. Once you crack that open, the seeds are inside and they're shaped like that. So the reference was to that, but I kind of stretched it out in a way that made it more like a handle over top of the actual word. So it creates
It's also like a tea kettle handle, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a handle. It's a reference to trying, you know, I mean, what we do is actually quite, we're a pretty traditional company in the sense that we sell high quality, unblended Japanese tea. So, you know, I didn't want it to feel old fashioned, but I did want to give some kind of tip of the hat to, you know, to the more traditional side of Japanese tea.
And you mentioned unblended, right? So talk to us about like the difference between blended, unblended, loose leaf, bag, tea bags, kind of.
Sure. So all tea, you know, true tea in the sense of it's the five categories of tea, which would, it really in Japan, you're not dealing with all of them, but you'd have like a white tea, green tea, oolong, black, or sometimes referred to as red tea, and then any fermented tea like puer or post-fermented teas. Those are the categories of tea that come from the plant Camellia sinensis, which is the, you know, grows subtropical areas all over Asia. It grows, you know, in India, Sri Lanka, South America. It's quite ubiquitous. But the way that that's processed is how you end up with certain styles of tea. Japan specifically deals primarily with green tea. Domestic market in Japan, when you're talking about tea, you're talking about green tea. But now for export markets, they've started, they initially, in, you know, a couple hundred years ago, were making black tea for the export market, stopped because it was hard to keep up with the price of China and India. They've actually returned to that now. So in Japan, they're producing black tea and green tea, as well as some oxidized oolongs as well, fermented teas in the countryside. So there actually is, like, once you start digging below the surface, there's a lot there. But yeah, our teas are loose teas, meaning that they're processed to be made in a teapot or a strainer. We actually do have a line of tea bags as well. People ask me, they're like, how could you do that? And I said, you know, to me, a tea bag is excellent design. It's great design. It's the problem isn't the bag. It's what's in the bag.
Sure.
So if you can, you know, we work with a manufacturer in Japan who makes fantastic material tea bags. And the product that we put inside is loose leaf tea that we just have a machine that cuts it so that it infuses quicker.
Mm.
But yeah, we do sell loose tea as well as the tea bags, and then matcha powder, which is the green tea that's been milled.
Yeah. And I think that's so important to talk about, too, is like matcha, right? Because it was the proliferation of that word. I think people just kind of equate matcha as like green tea from Japan. But can you kind of like tell us and share with the world like exactly what matcha is as opposed to the Japanese green tea?
Yeah. So, well, it is in its
it is a green
basic
tea,
sense. It's a Japanese green tea. It has its roots in China, actually. It was the reason it's powdered was tea, like a lot of things when it was first discovered, it was consumed more as a medicine. So mm-hmm. it was just an easy way to get it into your system. You know, you have a coarse leaf, chewing on the leaf wasn't great. They found that, almost like mortar and pestle style, like grinding it into a shape or a delivery serving size that was good to, just to get it into your body. Because they in China, they realized pretty quickly that it had psychoactive effects, caffeine, theanine. It was producing a favorable feeling in the body. So when the tea, when tea ended up migrating to Japan from China, it was introduced in that form. And like Japan has done with so many things, it takes that and it said, well, we can improve that. Mm. So it's funny that once it was introduced, powdered tea, which is matcha, was introduced to Japan, it actually started to sort of fade away in China. So they moved on to other forms. You had brick like pu'er style
cakes.
Then you had the decocted tea, which was what you would refer to now as loose leaf tea. Mm. So, but Japan has sort of held that tradition because it became something that was really ingrained with the culture. So if you're familiar with Sado, or Japanese tea ceremony, that was a huge turning point in terms of dynamics of Japan. And if you read history, it's really like amazing how tea intersects with Japanese history. But it was codified in a way that it wasn't just going to go away. Matcha really became part of the historical fabric. And today it's still something that, is actually in a lot of ways compared to other traditional Japanese crafts is really flourishing outside of Japan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about kind of like your early euphoric moments maybe. Were there, and you've been in business for quite a bit now, were there any kind of moments of failure or times that are just like really challenging for you as well along the way?
Yeah, I mean, any time you have, a business, there's things you run into. So yeah, I mean, we've had plenty of setbacks. We've had, I've gone through having partners, not having partners, figuring out what the direction of the brand should be, having customers, not having customers. I mean, absolutely. I'm still every day I wake up, it's like elation and also like, what's going to happen? I mean, I have that sort of like mind of like, well, something's going to go wrong. And inevitably it does. Yeah. Part of the business for sure.
How do you kind of have that mindset though to tackle that every day?
Well, the thing I always feel really confident about is our product. And with that in mind, I feel like regardless of like sort of setbacks that will happen along the way, like I believe in the product and I believe in the people we work with in Japan. And it doesn't mean we're, we can't be harmed, but I do feel like looking to the people, especially, and this is something I've really learned in Japan, that like to keep a business, around for a while, it really comes down to like, I think, most obviously two things, which is the quality of their product and then your service, like which would be your hospitality, like how you're taking care of your customers.
Yeah.
And those are the two things that I just focus on. I really continue. If I put my attention there, I feel like you can sort of figure out the inevitable, snares you're going to step in.
I love that. In terms of the service aspect, which is what I'm really excited to talk about, talk to a little bit about the service aspect of what you're doing, because I think it's like a slippery slope, right? In terms of like how you're conversing with guests or customers, because maybe they come in with a predisposed notion of what tea is, what it should taste like. So
yeah, so currently the way that we would be like, our service style would be a few different ways. So just to step back, number one, we work with a lot of restaurants. So
yeah.
We do a lot of, we advise a lot of restaurants on their tea programs, everything from them reaching out to us and wanting to, we want to have tea on our menu. Can you help? Looking at what, their setup is,
right,
what their goals are, and also how to build a profitable tea business within their restaurant. That's one type of service. So I like that. I like people. I like to talk. So I find that really, natural, I would say. So that's one form of service. Another would be, if you come into our store, I'm there most days, but I'm not always there. But when I am, it's about like just making it really clear for people where they are, number one, because we have a small shop on a second floor. And sometimes people walk in like, am I in someone's house?
Yeah, it's very
Can
intimate.
Can I come in here?
It's
it is.
Intimate.
And, the number one thing is just like, come on in. You can relax. And then I just give, a short overview of what they're experiencing, you know, what we do, what's available, how we can help, make samples. And then if someone, especially if someone's really showing interest, that's what I love. I'm happy to talk to people to explain about, you know, the varieties of tea we carry, or, you know, the type of incense that we have, or the, you know, my wife's a ceramicist as well, so her work is there and I can talk to that. So I just, that's my world. Kettle is like the stuff that I'm so interested in, and sharing it is my passion. So I feel like it's, people tend to feel pretty relaxed there because it's very informal, even though you mentioned some of the products we sell are, you know, are premium. But for me, premium quality doesn't always map necessarily to exactly. It's got to be expensive. Yeah. So I think people are also sort of relaxed when they can feel like, okay, there's something I can get here for $14. Like, you know, and oftentimes, you know, just them understanding that not everything in the store is going to, you know, max out their credit card, like they feel generally more relaxed. Yeah. And then I would say the third element is customer service through our e-commerce site. Yeah. So we're, you know, we have a office, I have an office in Japan. We do all our fulfillment direct from the source. So if you go on our website, it's in native English. We actually, you place your order and then we have a team that will ship it directly from Japan. And inevitably, like shipping something 6,000 miles, there's going to be little snags along the way. So it's just being able to deal with customers that way as well, what we can do to help them if their package gets delayed, or if, you know, there's a you know, something's not right. That's also really important for us to have our customer service at the same level as our products.
So everything that you order online from the store is shipped and fulfilled directly from the source?
Correct. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's sort of almost a separate line of business. I mean, what we have here in New York is you can come in, you can leave that day with the tea. But for us, we just thought it would be an interesting business model. Like we actually don't hold tons of inventory because in Japan, they can process the tea as we need it. Because what happens, just real quick, is right now the tea is being harvested and it's manufactured into a state that's stable but unfinished. It's called Aracha. So the Aracha is put into the refrigeration, and then throughout the year, in order to service customers, you know, they pull it out from the refrigeration and they finish the manufacturing.
Yeah.
And that way, when you smell it, when you taste it, when you look at it, it's you think like this was just harvested, but you can get, you know, fresh tea 11 months after it was picked because of that.
Wow.
So we actually get our tea from as needed from our growers. So we will, not every farmer works this way, but a lot of the people we work with, for example, our the matcha, our producers will hold it for us in cold storage, and we say, hey, we need X amount of cans. They'll pull it out. They'll finish, you know, for example, then they would mill it and we would get it fresh. That way we're not, you know, forecasting like, okay, we're going to need this much for the year. Let's order it now and have it sit in a warehouse. We don't do that.
That's very smart, I think. Right?
Yeah,
everything is very fresh to order almost.
Yeah, and I, you know, and for me, I'm always trying to make sure like the business is as, you know, like someone could say, oh, well, it's not as fresh as Japan. Like, you know, that was one thing I just was like, you know, they would be right, but it is as fresh as Japan because it comes
straight
literally.
From Japan.
Yeah, I mean, and people also love getting international mail. People get emails all the time like, oh my God, this is so cool.
And like, does it have
this,
Japanese
this
on there?
It actually came from Japan. And I was like, yeah. So, I mean, some people probably don't really care, but we do get people that like it.
And you briefly mentioned that your wife is a ceramist.
Yeah, so she, my wife Minami, is a potter. So she makes ceramics. She works with, you know, clays here from the States, and then she does her own glazes, and she makes everything from teaware to homeware, sculpture.
So. That also sounds like a perfect match. Like, how did you guys also meet? And
oh, this is another. This is one of my favorite stories. So we work with one of my favorite patisseries in Dumbo called Burrow Bakery.
It's sure.
Are you familiar with them?
No, no, no.
They're a couple, a Japanese couple, and they're, you know, when I first started the business, I loved them, and they started carrying my tea. I was so excited and became friends with them, and I would run a lot with the owner. And at one point, I was in Japan for work, and it was he and his wife's 10-year wedding anniversary.
Sure.
And he reached out to me, and he said, hey, can you help us get a reservation at Per Se? I want to surprise Ayako and go you know, have the meal there. And they're a customer of ours, so I set it up, and they were all ready to go. And then something happened. I think she got sick or something, and they had to cancel the reservation. And he felt so bad about it that he reached out again saying, oh my God, I feel so bad. Like, this was, you know, you really went out and we are canceling, so I don't want it to reflect poorly on you. And
yeah.
I said, don't worry about it at all. But he was persistent and was saying, well, how can I make it up to you? So partly because it was true and partly because I just wanted him to not feel bad and then also get off the phone, I said, well, when I get back, you can introduce me to, you know, you always have these interesting, like, yeah. cool, cute yeah. women.
And this was kind of like joking.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But still, like, also true. I mean, I'll be honest. So totally forgot I said it. Two right. months later, or 2.5 months, sure. I get back. I get a text message. We found someone. When can we have dinner? And I was like racking my brain. I'm like, found someone. Oh, my God. He really took it to heart. And it was the only setup date I've ever been on. And they came over to my place. I, you know, met Minami that
night.
So it was
like a double
She made me laugh within 2 minutes, like, really hard. And this was her, like, she's, you know, she was pretty shy meeting me right away. But we hit it off and we got married 10 months later.
Wow.
Yeah.
Into a relationship, huh?
Yeah. It's amazing. Every time I see the people from Burrow, I'm like, thank you, thank you, thank you. So I'm lucky.
So she was always a ceramicist when you met her, too?
No, she actually moved from Tokyo to New York sort of spontaneously. Uh-huh. She was in textile design. She worked in Tokyo in textiles. But artistic, you know, has a sense yeah. of texture, a really great eye.
Yeah.
And funny enough, she's like, I've always wanted to do pottery. So she started doing pottery in the United States, which is, it's just the way, you know, she's very like, you know, she does what she wants. And I like that about
yeah.
her. Yeah,
I love that. Because that's the other thing I noticed about the shop, right, is the design of the store itself, but also the pottery and mm-hmm. the ceramics that you have are all really, really beautiful. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's... when your physical space is really important, you know, I still think like going into someone's store is like a special thing, and mm-hmm. it's special for me to get a chance to have someone that cares enough to walk through mm-hmm. the door. So, you know, we love, you know, the design and that element as well as the ceramics. It makes a big impact.
Yeah.
You know, tea, people kind of get to tea through the, like, oh, they have plates, you know, like they see stuff that they recognize
that.
And then all, it's a thread that leads to the tea. So everything we have in the store kind of leads back to the tea. Mm-hmm. That's the idea.
Mm-hmm. Something I do on the show with every guest is have them define the word hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I were to ask you what that meant, what would that mean to you?
It's a great question. I mean, hospitality, I think, for the way that I view it, is giving people part of myself. So as I mentioned earlier, Kettle has grown from just an, you know, it's so much about what I'm interested in and what I care about and the things that are important to me, and kind of understanding that, hey, I think these could be important for other people too. Like, the mm-hmm. things that I care about could be things that other people care about, and mm-hmm. sharing that and really taking great pride and respect for the people who make our products and the people who buy our products. And the hospitality is understanding that, you know,
sure.
that sort of I'm a link in this chain between someone who makes something, for example, one of our growers or tea producers, and really understanding their story and then sharing it to the person who's coming to, you know, to purchase the tea.
Yeah.
And understanding that connection and following through in the right ways, really respecting the product as a form of hospitality, not only to the person who made it, but caring enough that the person who's going to buy it knows that we really took great pains. And then all the other, you know, typical trappings, like making sure, not just being respectful,
yeah.
You know, looking people in the eyes, like,
yeah.
I've learned a lot of really amazing things from the restaurants we work with,
you yeah
know, and just seeing hospitality. There is some, you know, definable aspects of hospitality that I've just been really, you know, I was in San Francisco with a friend recently, and we dined out, and afterwards we talked about the service, and she was breaking down the fabric in the woman's people taking care of us had a wrinkle in her you know, sort of where her arm bends in her sleeve, and my friend said that's because she's not hanging her suits correctly. Like, you have, I know that they have 3 suits and they have to hang them so that the suits actually, you know, lay correctly. And that level of precision, I was like, oh my God. Like, she was seeing these micro details that were just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And being able to, you know, work in see that environment and the care that people take, and
yeah.
really, like, you know, those important details, like,
yeah.
it's that's been really amazing.
Yeah. Does she work in a restaurant?
She does, yeah. She works in fine dining, and she's worked everywhere. So she's like, she's amazing. She's so sweet, but she's like, she
also
doesn't
very, like,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this was a 3 Michelin star restaurant we were in, and it was like, you know, she was like, she's, you know, in the Terminator, when you see through the Terminator's eyes and all the data's there, I feel like
same thing, right?
Yeah, but in a good way, in a good way.
Lastly, you know, passion. Why are you so passionate about what you do?
I feel lucky to be able to have an interest that translates into being able to make a living. You know, I mean, I tried with music really hard, and unfortunately, I had a deep passion, and I still do, but it didn't translate. The value exchange wasn't as well understood. So, being able to do something and, you know, and share what I care about, share what I love, and get to do it with my wife and you know, I feel like create something really unique and share something really unique is, you know, that's what I love to do. And, you know, I don't think too deeply about it. I think a great business has to be a combination of intuition and, you know, like hard truths and facts and data. Like I don't think it's all intuition at all. But I do think there is an element of following what you're, you know, what you care about and taking feedback, you know, and understanding quickly, like, okay, doesn't matter how much I love this, this isn't going to really translate.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, trying to hold on to something and see it fail. I do feel like you have to be nimble, but you have to really care about what you're doing. And that kind of combination, that there's some improvisation in there that's what I like to do. I like to improvise. So I feel like I get to do that with people now instead of instruments.
That's awesome. For people that want to try your tea online or visit your store, you can share a little bit about.
Yeah, so you can just type KETTLTEA, Kettle Tea, into Google and find our website. We've actually really, this year, we're doing a lot with the literature and the on our blog, so a lot of educational material. We do tastings at our store, which is in Williamsburg, neighborhood of Brooklyn. And then this year we'll be expanding into a new space. Can't share too much about that yet, but we'll have some new opportunities for people to come and see us.
And taste.
Yeah. But you can check us out online if you don't live in New York, or if you do, come by. And we're also available, you know, throughout, you know, restaurants in the United States. So maybe you've had us before, I hope.
Awesome. Thank you, Zach.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you for tuning into another episode of With Warm Welcome. I had a really great time sitting down with Zach today, so I just wanted to thank him for coming in and spending time with me here in the studio. I also wanted to share with you that there is a new website for the podcast. It's withwarmwelcome.com, and the new website has great, easy playback options, so you can listen to all the episodes that I've had without having to download Spotify or Apple Podcasts, just right off the website. Each episode has its page as well, and that page will include episode notes, kind of like more behind-the-scenes stories, or even kind of the social media handle, like Instagram handles, or the websites of these individuals and guests that were on my show, in case you wanted to follow the work further. And I would love to hear what you think about this website. Just DM me @withwarmwelcome, or you can shoot me an email, arnold@withwarmwelcome.com.